Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gallen, and joining me in studio right now from the Lawns area, Ken Summers, who's the candidate for the 110th District for State Representative of Michigan, looking to follow up from Scott Diana, who's finishing his third term, term limited, and so we're going to be looking for a new state representative. Mr. Summers, you want to be that guy?
Absolutely. As you mentioned, Scott Dianda is term limited out and will be running for the state senate. So I've decided to run to be the next state representative from the Western UP.
Okay, and you're originally from the area?
Absolutely. I was born and raised down in Lawns. Everybody in my family basically worked down at the Celotex ceiling tile factory. Other side of my family, plumbers and pipe fitters and nurses. And that's where I was born and raised. And I joke with folks that I know my way around every town I go to because I played basketball or football in every single one of them. So I'm getting reacquainted with all my old stomping grounds.
Where'd you graduate college from?
I went to Northern Michigan University from 96 to 2000 and graduated from Northern.
Okay. And what field did you go in?
I got a finance degree and I went down to the big city of Chicago for about a decade and worked on the Chicago Board of Trade using my finance degree. And you know, at some point in 2012, I said that was enough of that and had a 2-year-old son at the time and decided to move my family back to Michigan and raise my son right here where I grew up.
Were you able to continue working through your Chicago employment while you were up here?
Absolutely. You know, with the technology changes, you know, like I said, in 2012, I was called back to the Lawns High School to give the commencement speech to the graduates. And as I was writing that speech and giving it, I realized I should probably take some of that sage advice I was giving those 18-year-olds. And that was in May. And in September, I had my family move back. And the reason I could do that is because, you know, with technology, everything I was doing was transitioning to the computer. So my wife and I moved back and I was able to work from home for quite a while. And we then ended up starting a small business down in Lawns, a resale and consignment business. And we've been basically trying to lift up our community down in Berrigan County for about the last 5 years. My wife and I pretty much sit on every board that you can imagine, from the Chamber of Commerce to the Community Foundation to the school boards, just trying to give back to our community.
Is this your first time running for an office?
Well, I've been on the Lawns Area School Board, the Lawns Village Council, the president of the Community Foundation, but this is really a major, major office. So, okay. Yes.
But you've been involved in local politics for at least a little bit.
Absolutely, Rick. The last 5 years, I've been, you know, giving my time back to Berrigan County quite a bit.
Well, why make the jump to the state legislature?
You know, people ask me why I want to run, and it's basically to help people in my community. Well, I consider the whole UP, especially the Western UP, my community. So if I can help 90,000 people in the Western UP versus the 8,000 people in Berrigan County, I think it's time to make that jump.
Now, of course, we mentioned about Diana having to move on or step down, doing whatever he's got to do. Of course, he's running for state senate because he's term limited, and he's endorsed you as the Democrat candidate. Of course, right now you are the only candidate that's filed for this going up towards the primary, but there's still time for other people to file if they want. What does it mean to just have, you know, Scott's backing at this point?
You know, I'm not sure that came real easy. I started last 4th of July walking in parades with Scott and spending about 6,000 to 8,000 miles of windshield time traveling across the Western UP in July and August, sitting next to him, talking to him, getting his ideas of how folks in the district expect you to be a state representative, working hard, and he saw that. And my endorsement came in January after spending 6 months with him on the road, you know, getting to know how to be the next state representative.
Now, would you describe, you know, if you were to get elected, that you would continue carrying the torch that Diana has been for these last 3 terms, or would you do things differently?
Absolutely, Rick. Scott and I line up pretty good on many issues. We consider ourselves what I call Uper Democrats or old school FDR type Democrats that you know, kind of, it's about people, you know. We're not down in Lansing to represent corporate lobbyists or anything like that. We've had conversations in that car about if you do what you're supposed to do, you represent the people in your district and have their back, you know, and come home every weekend and answer to them, you should have no problem being the next state representative.
All right, well, let's talk about some of those issues that are important to you. Just, you know, doing just a quick search just on what you have posted up. One of the things that came up was your stance for education, wanting to see more funding for education and especially for career and technical education.
Absolutely. Education is, you know, one of the pillars that I believe that can move the state of Michigan forward along with healthcare. But education specifically, we've gotten away from career technical skilled trade education. In the 70s, you could leave school in your senior year and go do an apprenticeship or go to the local machine shop and learn how to become a machinist. We've gotten away from that, and we've told everybody they have to go to college. And for every one college job there is, there's about seven that are out there that don't require college. So we need to go to a program that gives students a path. And one path can be the normal college track. The other path needs to be some sort of career technical education. We need to have folks ready to go into the workforce 0 to 18 months after they graduate from high school. And I don't know if that's a 5-year high school plan where when you come out of high school, you're 30 college credits in, you already have your apprenticeship certifications, whatever that may be, but we need to change the way we look at education. And one of the main problems is we're underfunding education. Study after study over the last few weeks, months, have come out saying that, you know, excluding busing, excluding heat, excluding many things, it costs $9,300 roughly we should be spending per pupil. And our base rate right now in the Western UP is about $7,600. So we're falling way short on how we're funding education. And, you know, we need to really take a look at how we change those things.
Well, we know it's an important issue to the people that live here in the Copper Country Intermediate School District, since the voters here voted to approve a millage to support CTE education here. But, you know, it's just our local area that's doing this. But and a lot of people said that funding should have been coming from the state. It shouldn't have been a special millage to be able to fund basically education. It's, you know, it's something that the school should already be providing.
I completely agree with that. You know, there is a discrepancy of how we fund each student in this state. You know, there's students getting $10,000, $12,000, up to $14,000 all over the state of Michigan per pupil. Our schools here in the Western UP with our long busing, our long heating days are basically getting that $7,600 base rate. When I see PTOs raising money for school playground equipment, for desks, for books, people asking for millages for roofs, sinking fund millages. If you ask me, those are things that should be funded through our state tax dollars that we're already paying.
Okay, and of course, it's not cheap to do so. And another thing that you had mentioned that is also kind of expensive is providing healthcare. And when people talk about making healthcare more affordable or improving access, a lot of times what we're talking about is providing funding for healthcare or providing, you know, healthcare at low or no cost. The state is in a tough bind with trying to do that. And of course, the federal health plan is in flux, we'll put it that way. We don't really know where it's going to go. As a state legislature, what can you really do about that problem?
That's a good question. As a state legislature, there isn't much you can do, quite honestly. It is a federal issue, but it seems like more and more the federal government is passing the buck down to the states. And when it does that, we need to be ready to pick up the ball, quite frankly. And we see it all across the world. We see it in our Medicare program. It works. There aren't people marching in the streets in Finland and Germany and all across the world saying, take away my universal health care. If they were, I might think differently. But right now we have a for-profit system with insurance companies getting rich, many people in the healthcare getting rich, and 20, 30 million people in the richest country in the world basically dying because they don't have access to healthcare. That doesn't seem like the greatest country in the world to me.
Where we live, it produces problems that, you know, with healthcare, just because it's so hard to get the access to that care. You have to travel long distances. Sometimes you have to go over to Wisconsin or Minnesota. And once you start doing that, then some insurances don't carry over because you're going across state lines. And then your other choice is to go all the way down to Ann Arbor, where, you know, if you don't have transportation, then you've got, you know, that issue as well. What can we do as a state to be able to increase the access locally so people are able to get, you know, there's two universities here, but yet we're underserved even with two hospitals when it comes to medical care.
And that's a good point. We, right now, we're talking about cutting Medicaid and Medicare on the federal level. People don't realize that our number one provider of jobs in the Western UP are our rural hospitals. If you cut Medicaid and Medicare, those hospitals possibly go out of business. When those hospitals go out of business, the seniors that are retired here have no place to get healthcare. They would have to drive to Green Bay or Marquette to get healthcare, so they're going to not want to live here. When you lose those jobs, you lose those school students. It's a domino effect. So one thing we need to do is make sure that doesn't happen. But another thing you mentioned about access to high quality healthcare, when it's in a for-profit system, much like it is currently, the hospital in Marquette right now is building a brand new facility, but because there is liability and no profit in addiction medicine, they're not putting that wing on that new hospital and not providing that service, right? So if we get the profit out of the healthcare industry, we might be able to make sure that those big, large regional hospitals that we want would have the healthcare that we truly need.
You just mentioned about the addiction medication. Now you're talking about, you know, treating the opiate epidemic that's going on and providing funding to be able to do that.
Absolutely. You know, everybody's talking about this epidemic, and they're, because it's affecting every community in this country, right? And they're talking about throwing $1 billion at it when everybody is telling you it's $100 billion or $300 billion problem. So are they really serious about providing help? But, you know, it goes back to the root of the problem. Why are these problems out there? Does it start with people not having hope? They don't see a path to the middle class. They don't see a path to their future, right? They're unhealthy. They're not educated. They see a minimum wage job in their future, and they don't see the path that 50 years ago you saw when you graduated from high school of working a job and starting a family and being able to raise your family. We got to get back to fixing the income inequality and giving people a path to support a family and give them hope. And that might take care of some of the addiction problems in our country.
And a question that's related both to the opiate epidemic, because some people say it would be a way to alleviate some of those that are seeking out those for those products for drugs, and also because it's a healthcare issue. When it comes to medical marijuana, now when the laws went into effect last December, most of the communities here said thanks, but no thanks, not in our area. And they actually put some businesses locally out of business here. The recreational marijuana question is going to come up in a ballot soon, possibly even this year. Do you see that increasing access to medical marijuana as something that can help the opiate epidemic?
You know, we sometimes like to do things and not look at the unintended consequences. The first thing we need to do is take a look at Portugal, take a look at Colorado, and see what they've done right, see what they've done wrong. See where the problems are in their programs. Because when it goes on the ballot in November, I'm fairly confident that it's going to be approved. So if it's going to be approved, we need to know how to do it right. Not just do it, but really look at the pros and cons and get a plan in place so that, we can get this done.
All right, moving on, because you have a very interesting story, just your background story of how you said how you grew up in Lawns, went to Northern Michigan University, and then, like a lot of our youth, found a job outside of the area. You go to Chicago, and you do very well for yourself. You come back to the area and move back, and, of course, we see that a lot of times, too, where people come back to the area to reestablish themselves and make a living here. One of the reasons why you were able to do it, because you mentioned, was that the technology has improved. But it hasn't improved for everybody. You live in Lawns. I live in Calumet and work in Houghton. So I've got access to things like high-speed internet, you know, pretty easy. But it's not available everywhere, and it's certainly not inexpensive.
Absolutely. When I talk about infrastructure, I talk about, you know, bridges to broadband, right? 25% of our students here in the UP don't have access to internet broadband when they go home after school. So I'm talking to superintendents, and they're like, yeah, we're 1-to-1 with our computers. They go 100 yards away from the school. The kids don't have internet. Well, what good does that do our students? We need to make sure when we build our infrastructure, we're building broadband into that. And that not only helps our students, but it also helps any high-tech companies that want to relocate here. I was fortunate enough, and it really mattered where I lived when I first moved back, because I didn't have access and I needed access to high-speed internet. So with the changing climate in the job market throughout the country, I think this is one of our best resources right now. Is people love what we have to offer here in the Western UP when they're not working, right? All the skiing, all the snowmobiling, all the hunting, all the stuff we love to do, but they have to have a job to support their family. And if you can work from home, you can work from the internet, you can do your business, you can use our rural airport and fly to Chicago for $167 in an hour and get where you need to go and then get back here and live your life and have your fun here. That's what we need to do. We need to be drawing people back in with those high-tech jobs that they can do from home using the broadband internet.
You know, I always found that to be one of the enigmas of the area. If I go travel anywhere in the country and present a brochure to somebody and say, you know, look at this great place to live. It's got two major hospitals, plus other, you know, plenty of other medical care facilities, two universities. It has, you know, some of the best outdoor year-round recreation you're going to find anywhere in the world, and cheap housing, and just plenty of land, opportunity to buy real estate. They would go, wow, where is this place? I want to move there. I want to build my business there. I want to do everything. Yet we have so little when it comes to industry, and we struggle to attract businesses to come here, even though that brochure would be a no-brainer selling point.
Absolutely. You know, every day that I was in Chicago, I thought about the weekends that I'd come home. At some point I bought a little piece of property and put a camper on there and came back all the time and slept in the camper on weekends because I wanted to be on Lake Superior again. You know, like you said, choose anywhere in the country to live. I choose here because it's my home and I love it. What we need to do is make sure that people are able to start jobs here, start companies here. And it starts with the infrastructure. We have to make sure that they have employees that are educated, make sure that their electrical rates are cheap, their inputs are cheap. Make sure that they have folks that can do the work for their businesses. And that all, it's not going to happen tomorrow. But we need to invest in the right things, and that's investing in healthy, educated people and our infrastructure to make that happen 10 years from now when it really matters.
Well, you've electricity rates that you just mentioned, or energy costs in general, we were among the highest in the country. Still, it's kind of one of those, everybody wrings their hands over it. They know a solution needs to be presented, but viable solutions are few and far between, and the ones that people have don't seem to get off the ground. How are we going to change that?
You know, you mentioned that the solutions are few and far between, and that's because there's so many moving parts. The federal government's involved. There's all sorts of agencies involved. But we have a problem. I pay 26, 27 cents a kilowatt hour, just like everybody else up here in the Keweenaw. And the national average is 11 cents a kilowatt hour. You know, they're producing solar in Arizona for 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Not only does it need to come down for local residents, but 26 cents a kilowatt hour doesn't inspire a business that uses lots of electricity to come here and establish, right? So, unfortunately, I think the federal government is failing us when it comes to that. So the only way I see at this point is to do it individually, each community by community. And that starts with great programs like Michigan Tech and Launce have going on right now, where they're talking about building a solar farm in the industrial park and selling individual panels to folks. They're talking about one down in Gwynn, like a 400,000 panel solar farm. You know, the technology is there now, and we really need to take a look at bringing down these rates. It's unacceptable, quite frankly.
The solar array that they're talking about for the village of Lund, but you know, even that, admittedly, they're saying it's not going to bring down electric rates. Of course, the Lawns has its own utility, so they don't have to share some of the problems that we do. But do you live in the village or just outside?
I live outside the village, but okay. I've lived in the village when I first moved back. So okay.
I wasn't sure if you were part of the Lawns, the municipal utility there.
No, but being on the village board, I really know how it works. And that's one of my problems. They're part of a cooperative, and they're able to bring electricity in for 12, 13 cents a kilowatt hour, right to Lawns. Over in Ironwood, I talk about electricity rates, and they have no idea what I'm talking about because they're paying 7 to 9 cents a kilowatt hour. So I have trouble believing, quite frankly, that you can bring power to Lawns, power to Ishpeming, power to Ironwood for 7 to 13 cents a kilowatt hour, but you can't bring it to Houghton and the Keweenaw for under 26 cents a kilowatt hour. That's a problem, and we need to really take a look at how to solve that.
Sure. We're getting two new power plants being built here in the Upper Peninsula, and again, they're saying, well, it's going to be great to have them, but it's still not going to lower your electric bills. You know, again, I ask everybody that sits in your chair, okay, so what are the solutions? Again, the solutions, unfortunately, are few and far between because you're right. There are a lot of moving parts, and everybody knows it's a problem. Nobody can quite explain why it's such a big of a problem, and even harder to find a solution that works.
Absolutely. We really need to get our senators, our congressmen, all the state reps, all on the same page and solve this problem, as well as the local communities. If they're not going to do it, maybe we need to do it ourselves. It's well within the rights of, say, the city of Houghton and Hancock to start a municipal power company, just like Lawns has, just like I believe Wakefield or Bessemer have one as well, where we do what Marquette did. We go over to Finland, get a Wärtsilä engine, fire it up, and produce our own power and see where the rates end up.
This show will air the same weekend that, of course, this airs on Sunday. And then yesterday, the young people, the kids, quite literally the students, marched across the Portage Lake Lift Bridge with a lot of support to try to end gun violence in their schools. Since we had a couple of minutes before the show closed out, any words for them?
You know, absolutely. There's a lot of divisive issues in this country where 50% are going to fall on one side, 50% are going to fall on the other. But I got to be honest, I really respect either side that comes up and is willing to take a stand and not duck the issue, right? Stand up, fight for what you believe in, and use your First Amendment right to do that. And, you know, I believe they're doing that. And to that note, I obviously don't have all the answers. I don't think anybody does. But the one thing I can promise is I'm willing to have the conversation. I'm willing to ask the questions. And we can decide on things. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there on some of these issues where 80, 90% of the country agrees on some of the things that should be done. Well, maybe we start there and start that baseline. You know, for 20 years, since 1994, we haven't done anything on many issues, whether it be education, gun control, many issues. So we need to start having some tough conversations. And, you know, I don't think you want folks that are way to one side in the room and folks that are way to the other side of the room, because they end up yelling at each other and nothing gets accomplished. I think you need representatives in the room that grew up here, understand our culture, understand what it means to have grown up here, to, like myself, have a grandfather as a gunsmith that hunted my whole life, understand everything about what's going on, and can have the conversation in the room.
My guest has been Ken Summers, candidate for state representative. Ken, if somebody wants to know more about your campaign, how do they do that?
Absolutely. The best way is to follow us on Facebook at Vote Ken Summers, or our website is www.votekensummers.com, and you can always give me a call.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.